Good morning. One Douglas Meng, Chris Meng, Curtis Meng contacted me about X-ray diffraction in the history of soil mineralogy. I thought probably I'm the least qualified person to talk in this topic because in this audience, I learned many of you have had much, much more experience in X-ray diffraction than I have. But fortunately, about 2 years ago, when I accepted a faculty position at the Texas A&M University, I had the chance to evaluate a lot new equipment, so I had the chance to go back to learn a little bit more. So today, what I'm going to do is tell a little bit about the very early history of X-ray diffraction in soil mineralogy. I have one good reason to do that, because in the early days, we had only few publications, so it's much easier to read those references. The second one part will be advances in instrumentation. The third one will be advances in data analysis, how to do phase identification, quantification analysis, and structure analysis. The last part will be some challenging issues, not only challenging in terms of scientific problems, and also challenges for our new generation in soil mineralogy. This is the first publication related using X-ray diffraction to study soil colloids, which was published in 1930 in Soil Science by Hendricks Group. And since then, every 10 years, probably the first couple of decades, we have only a handful of papers using X-ray diffraction to study soil minerals. So this is one particular reason why I just said a very brief history of early history, not later on. Later on, we have too many publications to read. But we can see a steady growth in the last few decades. And after 2000, we have a little bit over 700 publications. If I just key in XRD and soil mineralogy in Cifanda. So in the early days, in the 30s, most work in U.S. were done in USA, Hendricks Group, Alexander Hendricks, and Helmer, and also Jackson. And in Europe, the earliest paper was in 1935. And in Australia, in 1940, Canada, 1950s. And in China, Dr. Shun did some work with Jackson, at Wisconsin, 1952. South Africa, we had some publication 1952-55, and then in Japan, they did some work in 1950s as well. In terms of quantitative analysis for soil mineralogy, in the first publication prize of Jackson's group, they have done a lot of reference minerals, mixed reference minerals together to record X-ray patterns. And more or less similar to our reference intensity ratio method that was done by Philip and Joe White in 1951. So this is two diagrams from the publication by Wenis and Jackson in 1948. On the left side, some standard minerals. They mixed quartz, arbites, and micas together according to different ratios, record those patterns. And then on the right side, we have some real soil samples and also some of those reference patterns there. So by comparison, they can qualitatively say how much minerals we have in one sample. And Phillips and White's method probably is the approach we use a lot in recent years. Basically, is a reference intensity ratio method. They put sodium fluoride as internal standard, and then based on intensity ratio, they can find a linear relationship. And based on this linear relationship, they can quantify minerals there. When I cleaned up my lab 2 years ago and I tried to find a new room for the X-ray machine, we found out some pictures, so I would like to share with you. And this picture is Dr. George Conzi, probably some of many of you know him. He was very active in the 50s and 60s at Texas A&M University. Once I want to point out, on this action machine, we still had the double shear camera, and also we have the goliometer with Geiger count. On the back here, we still see another little machine to read those film on the action machine. And then on the right side, we have the chart recorder. So we have a lot of data still in file generated by him. This one is a double shell camera. We still use those in a swimmingology class as a demonstration how this work. Those who haven't used this kind of camera before, basically is we have a powdery sample in the center, and then you have electron beam heated, and then we generate diffraction cones. And then you have put a strip, a film strip around it, it will intersect, get those bands on the film. And we have a full load of those old X-ray patterns recorded by Dr. George Conze. So he did a huge project on Texas soils. We have a lot of those patterns there. Surprised to me, after 50 or even 60 years, those papers are still in good shape. Yeah. And this one is probably many of you know this gentleman here. He's in among our audience here, is Dr. Joe Dixon. This one was a very modern X-ray diffraction in the 60s. In the center, this is his X-ray fluorescence machine at Auburn University. And he shared with us this machine. He spent $9,000 on this machine on that day during the 60s. I'm wondering how much we can, what kind of machine we can buy with $9,000 right now. This one machine served us very well. It started in 1968, about 68 to 2008, until I came to the university, and still in very useful form, can still generate data. So when I started evaluating those instruments, I visited a few leading companies in the X-ray diffraction industry. I found out, I learned quite a bit, and so when I looked back to see how much technology have advanced, when I looked back in the first X-ray diffraction diffractometer used by William's father and brother, Bragg's father and son, you can see we can still have the same geometry they used about 8 years ago. So this is a lid box behind it, as the project that will show better. Behind that lid box was is the X-ray source, and then now we have a slit that's for X-ray come out, that's divergence slit and a crest. Divergence slit, anti-scattering slit again, and then it's the detector. Now, about 8 years ago, I was curious how they detect the signal by using this ionized chamber. Basically, they use the electroscope. I didn't understand well what it is, so we went to Wikipedia, found out actually it's a very, very simple device. Just two pieces of gold foil, and when they open up, they will have more charge. Surprisingly, based on this simple technology, they can get some very accurate crystal structure data. Probably most of us are familiar with those gas detectors for X-ray diffraction. This one is a gag detector, doesn't have any energy resolution. This one is a gas field proportional detector, has about 2 kilo EV high energy resolution. It's not good, it's not as good as hoped. And then for most modern X-ray diffraction diffractometers, you will see something like this. It's a fast detector. It's called a multi-strip detector. On this detector, there are many mini micro detectors here. On this particular model, which we have in our lab, is Lynx-I, it has 192 micro detectors on this. So basically, you have 192 detectors work for you simultaneously. So this is the reason right now we can record the X-ray patterns very faster. If we use the old method, the gas proportional detector, it will take us about 5 to 6 hours to record a full pattern, a powder pattern. But with this detector, it normally takes only about 2 to 3 minutes. And also on the new detectors, and sometimes we don't use monochromators anymore, but then this will generate some problem with ion fluorescence. So in that case, we can use this detector here on the right. Basically, it's energy dispersive detector. This one has energy resolution about 300 EV, so you can differentiate K beta, K alpha. So you can do, and also, of course, the fluorescence from ion. Not only that company has those detectors, all major X-ray diffractometer industry, they have the fast detectors. And this one is the first one. It's a one-dimensional and the microstrip, multi-strip detectors. And this one is from Pan-Atlantic, which is an old Philips. And this one, they have put a special monochromator on it for the X-ray fluorescence. And this is the second generation of fast detector. This one, you can put on the direct beam to the detector. So it can tolerate the high intense X-ray beam. And then this one is from Rigaku. They also have the fast detectors too. In addition to one dimensional detector, a lot of companies have focused a lot of research of effort on two dimensional detectors. Those two dimensional detectors right now put more and more CCD based charge coupled detectors. Those ones from Rigaku, this one from Bruker. With a two dimensional detector, you can have much, much faster detection. You can study texture, particle size distribution, crystallinity. So a lot of calculations can be done within a very short period of time. Another advance I have seen in the industry is this. Most of us are familiar with this Bragg-Brentano configuration. We have a non-focused X-ray source, primary solar slate and a divergence slate. This is your sample, and now an anti-scatter slate. Solar slit again, and now receiving slits. Probably this is the configuration most of us are using right now. But in the industry, actually, they have more options for us to do. One thing, you can use the point source. You can use two-dimensional detector, and also you can use transmission model as well. In addition to this, in the Rigaku, they even made it a little bit further, and they call it cross-beam optics. This one special device here, what we need to do is just take out some slit and insert a little slit. You can change the configuration within a few seconds. Such as if you want a regular Bragg-Brentano configuration, you just use this slit. But if you want a parallel beam, you just put in a parallel mirror there and now flip that slit to let the beam leak out. And if you're not satisfied with the X-ray source, you can use two double-bounced monochromator to get a K-alpha-1 or K-alpha-2 you need for X-ray diffraction. But for small-angle X-ray scattering, if you start nanoparticles, nanofilm, you want a very small, thin X-ray beam, you can use those. If you want to do mapping, you can just leak out one small X-ray beam by using an aperture there. So they're very handy, and you can just take out one slit or insert another one, you can change. Another major advantage I like the most probably is the alignment is not required anymore for modern X-ray diffractometers. During the evaluation, I went to Pan-Atlantic, so I put my hands on to change this sample staging. This is automated for large samples. We also put in the old way, just you have to manually put the samples on that stage. You can see basically we have a perfect alignment after changing the stages. And now right now to change X tubes is not that difficult anymore. It's just like a change a light bulb in our house. So after this, I changed the copper tube to cobalt tube, and now we can still see we have only 0.01 degree shift off from the theoretic position. So it's very accurate. We don't need alignment. This is our new X-ray diffractometer in our lab. This is Bruker Advanced D8 Advanced X-ray diffractometer. We have the energy dispersive detecting layer. We have the lynx eye, the multi-strap fast detecting layer. And also we have a scintillation detector on the back. We swap those detectors very frequently, just depends on our need. And I want to show you some of the patterns we recorded in the past, starting from November last year to July. This basically after changing the swap those detectors, we can see still those detectors are perfectly aligned, and there's no shift at all. So it's a very, very high accuracy. Another major advantage I like is the sample capability. We can put a lot of samples on the X-ray diffractometer right now. This one is a one tower. We can load 15 samples there. We can put the powdery samples there. We can put the clay films there, and a lot of things. And we have we have all the summer change, can put a six tower on there. So in total, we can put 90 samples on a diffractometer. Just push one button and forget about it. Next day, when you come, the data are ready for you to analyze. And another major advance, I think, in X-ray diffraction in soil mineralogy problem using the synchrotron-based X-ray technologies. There is one major advantage here. We can zoom in to a small area to do micro X-ray diffraction. At the same time, you can also do the X-ray absorption spectroscopy study. So you have the crystal structure information and the chemical species information together at the same time. So this one example from Nansen's group, they did manganese oxide bolosite. They did an X-ray diffraction, an X-ray absorption at the same time with a micro X-ray diffraction and a micro extended X-ray absorption fine structure analysis. So they can get both the structure and the chemical species information at the same time. So if you don't like the big machines, actually, on the market, and there's a trend. Right now, they're making the X-ray diffractometer smaller and smaller. This one was invented by Rigaku in the 1980s. They call it Mini Flex. It's a desktop X-ray diffractometer. It's about 20 years ago. And right now, I checked the website a few weeks ago, and they have one machine. Basically, you have a computer X-ray diffractometer, everything in one box here. So you can carry it. Another one I have seen is this tiny one. It's called a Tara. It weighs only about 15 kilograms. And you have actually portable X-ray diffractometer with you. What you need is just load a laptop computer to hook it up. But probably many of us know this gentleman here, which is Doug Ming in NASA in Houston. He brought this machine to Antarctica to test this machine. The reason they did this, because they had to launch it to the Mars. This machine, this tiny machine, has very attractive features here. One thing is it uses a two-dimensional detector layer, and it can give us X-ray diffraction pattern. At the same time, it can also tell us the chemical composition, because it has a relatively high energy resolution on those detectors, on that detector. So they can tell us the chemical composition as well. This is the tiny X-ray diffractometer they are going to send it to the Mars, on the Mars Science Laboratory. This is a part of the chemical mineralogy analysis laboratory on this machine. So we are very excited to hear from them about the mineralogy outside on the Earth we have used to work with. Another very important feature on the X-ray diffractometer probably some accessories. One accessory I like very much is the rect chamber on X-ray diffractometer. We can put this chamber on the X-ray machine very easily just by loosening two or three screws and then unplug, you're done. So it's very easy to put the accessories on. This one we can do dynamic structure changes monitoring. We can monitor solid state reactions. We can change the temperature from room temperature to 930 degrees. We can change the pressure. We can change the gas composition. Some of you are doing some reduction very sensitive reactions if you are interested in those. And then we can do those on those accessories. So there are several companies, and they produce a lot of different rect chambers. You can go to very low temperature, high temperature, it just depends on your need. And when we get the high quality data, and then is the data analysis part. I think most of us have learned actually mineral identification using those chemical index, Fink index, Hallowell index, and that method. But now most of the softwares can do computer-based search and match. You just hit a button and then the computer will tell you what minerals you may have. What you need to do is just nail down what's the best match. And also most of softwares right now, they can do semi-quantitative analysis based on peak height. In this case, we have one example basically has anhydride and gypsum. It will tell you we have 90% for anhydride and 10% for anhydride based on peak height here. Now, if you are not happy with the quality of the results, you can do quantitative analysis by peak or area. There are software to do that too. Or you can train that program a little bit with your standards, and then that machine will spill out some results for you. And more recently, people have used another approach. Basically, is a full pattern simulation approach. In this, and then there are two ways to do that. The first way to do this is record a series of reference minerals on the same machine you are going to analyze your sample, and then fit the pattern with the reference patterns, and then you can get a very accurate result if your reference samples match well with your sample. Right, that's the requirement. Another very important way to do that is called based on read refinement method. This method is based on structure model. If you don't have a reference mineral, but you know what mineral phase you have, you can search in the inorganic crystal structure database, find out the structure, and then just input this structure. You can do a simulation based on structure. Most of us are a little bit afraid about this technology, and somehow it's a little bit mysterious to us too. What exactly is a read refine method? This method actually was started in 1960s on neutron diffraction patterns. Neutron diffraction patterns normally are much more the peaks are much more symmetric, and then well defined. No, also no much broader, so it's much easier to simulate. That's the reason why we had the neutron diffraction refinement first, and then the X-ray diffraction. But people do use that, and also there are a lot of academic and commercial softwares to do read refinement. But some of them probably you are very familiar. GCSS is one of the free one, is the most famous one, and also Foolproof is another one. It's also free. In our lab, we also have Trepas, which is a commercial one. So most of us are a little bit afraid of this technology because we don't know what exactly the software are doing behind us. Actually, the principle is very, very simple. So the reason I want to show a little bit detail about this method, I wanted to attract more young students here to join me to do more quantitative analysis with rate refinement. So if we have an atom, such in this case, we have more than two electrons. If the incident beam and the diffracted beam are same direction, there's no phase relationship, phase loss here. But if we go to higher angle, because they travel different paths, then so we will have phase difference here. This will reduce the intensity. So here we have a term for it. It's called the atom scattering factor. Basically, it's with the amplitude of the wave to describe the combined diffraction pattern to the scattering by one electron. So this ratio we call the atom scattering factor. And then those have been tabulated and also they are available. So we don't need to worry about those. But what we need to worry about is the structure of the arrangement of the atoms in a crystal. So if we have the Bragg condition, and then waffle atoms have the same displacement where they diffract the beam, so we have those intensity from the first atom. But if we have two atoms and they're a little bit off, then this one offloads the diffract beam from the second atom will be in phase, but the second one will be different from the first one, so we'll be a little bit out of phase. So we can calculate, we can have another factor, it's called a structure factor, basically is an amplitude divided by the electron amplitude again. So in this way, once we learn this, we can calculate the intensity. Or vice versa, if we learn the intensity, we can calculate back. So this is the formula for that. To do those calculations, we need to do a lot of corrections before we put on the real intensity layers, which are temperature factors, absorption factor, Lorentz factor, primary extinguishing, secondary extinguishing, crystal size effect, strain, product strain effect, orientation effect. All of those, fortunately, have some physics behind those. So we have well-defined mathematical equations to describe them. And then we use the technology convolution method, we can refine all of those effects there. And if we cannot, don't have a physical method, don't have a physical base, we can also use physically mix some samples to get rid of or reduce the effect of some factors, such as in this case, we can reduce the orientation effect. So in the clay mineral society, people have done, particularly from geology people, they have done quite a bit using this method to try to quantify minerals. When they create a real scope contest in 2000, and then we have those contests every 2 years. Next year will be, we have another one. This method is, we can see, they use the refinement method, and it's one of the examples. How good is this method? We can say we have pretty good results. If in this case, we have 17 minerals in one specimen. Most results are very good, but we do have some bias here for clay minerals. So we have some work to do. Another very important application with software is a one-dimensional or oriented specimen simulation. For us, probably we are more interested in clay minerals, ferrosilicate clay minerals, and then we can simulate layer silicate using the industrialization. We can simulate water, hydromet, organic compound adsorption. We can also more simulate ferromanganate minerals. This is one pattern with the different intensification of smectite, enite, and then we can use those one-dimensional simulation, such as a new model, to do similar patterns about the intensification. And another sample, I have only two more slides. We can simulate water in the interlayer water or even the interlayer cations with this simulation by best fitting there. So you put the water and the copper calcium here, you can do that. And also in this example, manganese oxide such as bornite, they have a lot of polytypes, and we can simulate the real the experiment data with the proposed model and get the best fit, the best structure, and get the distribution of the interlayer cations and water. So in summary, X-ray diffraction still is an indispensable method for soil mineralogy analysis. And in the past few decades, the instruments have been greatly advanced, and an absolute 1% of quantitative error can be achieved. And it is very versatile to study structure properties. But it does require a little bit understanding what we are doing. So expertise in parameter refinement is very critical. And also we do need some other methods to verify our results. Let's say one more here. Okay, but we do have a little bit challenge here. I want to say we do need to verify the structure models. We need a systematic study, research about the effect of structure defects, substitution, such as the solid solution effect, and the models of clays and the polycrystalline minerals. Fortunately, we have the capability to do that. Right now, we're just some open, creative mind and enthusiastic people to do this work. The last slide, I will dedicate this presentation to my former supervisor, Dr. Joe Dixon, which he will be our next speaker. Thank you very much.